Hello, and welcome to KHOI's Community Bookshelf. We are reading The Horizontal World, Growing Up Wild in the Middle of Nowhere, by Deborah Marquardt, published in 2006 by Counterpoint, a member of the Perseus Books Group. We rejoin the story as the author is describing an incident where she was bringing her parents back from Montana to their home in North Dakota and hit a deer. Her mother has ignored Deborah's advice and insisted on calling her brother to come pick them up. And so it was decided. My brother would arrive late that night with his Suburban and tow dolly. We would all stay in a motel, and in the morning he would take us home, driving a confident 90 miles per hour with the wrecked Oldsmobile in tow. That afternoon, after everything was settled, we got a ride to a Comfort Inn on the south side of town. Once in the lobby, I stepped up to the front desk. As a former road musician, I had spent half my life checking in and out of motels. This was something I could do. "Two rooms," I said, and opened my wallet. "Non-smoking." I pulled out the platinum visa. It felt good in my hands as I snapped it onto the counter. "Oh, no!" My mother stepped up behind me and looked for a moment at the silver visa tucked under my fingers as if it were contraband. She smiled at the girl behind the counter. "We're all family," she said. "One room will do just fine." "I'm happy to pay for this," I said. All I wanted was a bath, a bed, 45 channels of mindless distraction, and a few hours of quiet. "You can't afford this, honey," my mother said. She slid my visa toward me on the counter. "You know you're not working right now." She opened her billfold to reveal a crisp row of 20s. "Let her spend her money if she wants," my father said, fatigue in his voice. He was near the front door, looking out the lobby window. He was scanning the cars in the parking lot, as if already expecting my brother to be there. "We should be way past Miles City by now," my mother said in a confidential tone to the girl behind the counter, as if motel policy required that we must explain why we needed a room. "But our daughter hit a deer with our car." She gestured toward me, the culprit. "A deer?" the girl behind the counter said, giving me a shocked look. By this time, I'd moved over by the Continental Breakfast Nook, but still my mother's voice followed me. "Our son is coming to get us," I heard her say, as I rounded the corner to the vending machines. "We didn't even see it coming," I heard the echo of my father's voice say. And I was almost to the stairwell when the girl behind the counter began to tell my parents about the time that she almost hit a deer. Chapter 10. Failures of the Heart. The last thing I said to my father was, "I'll be back." Not in black leather with an Uzi slung over my shoulder like the Terminator, but like the daughter I was, the one who left home and didn't come back for years, the one who rarely called or wrote. Although he was on the upswing, and the charge nurse at the hospital in Bismarck had joked with him that he was the healthiest guy in the ICU, the place where he had landed when he flatlined 3 days earlier in another ward, he still had serious problems, 3 large blockages that would require surgery. I came to appreciate the impossible gauntlet he faced that last morning when the doctors arrived. "I want to go home," was his most repeated sentence. But without surgery, we all knew he would never see home again. For days I'd been sitting in the hard-backed chairs, staring through the long glare of fluorescence, thinking that before I left, somewhere in the middle of the hospital workers coming and going, there might be a moment, some kind of exchange, just between the two of us. The talk would not be about dying. It would be about an old Packard he'd owned, or a hard winter he'd endured. He'd raise his hand in the air and point in that abstract way up and to the right, to the place where all his stories came from, describing the slope and pack of the drifts that year. And then everything would be understood between us. And I would hold those words under my tongue like a gold coin, smuggle them out of the hospital, and put them on my dashboard like a St. Christopher medal for the long drive home, where I was certain upon my arrival to receive a phone call informing me of his death. This was nothing that any of us talked about in the hospital, for we were best at talking around the edges of things. Mostly we spoke of our neighbors in the ICU, a young girl down the hall who had crashed her car into a bridge and was in an irreversible coma, and an old Greek man next door who was unconscious after a leveling stroke had left him with a single, involuntary spasm, a loud and irregular hiccup that sounded like a dog barking. All day and night we listened to his yelps, and we talked with his wife, who was also old and Greek and was incessantly using the ICU phone to make calls to places like Athens, Paris, and New York. "Mr. Thompson died last night," we'd say in a whisper about a patient three doors down. "He was an old farmer whose family I'd met in the waiting room the day before, just after he'd gone into heart surgery, the same surgery that our father was eventually going to need. That night in the waiting room, the oldest son had told me his father had said to him before going into surgery, 'I'll try like hell to make it through, but if I don't, I've had a good life.'" Maybe it was just the kind of thing you say at a time like that, mostly to comfort those around you. But I thought they were pretty good last words for an old man who had most likely spent much of his life outside of language, negotiating in grunts and curses with livestock and tractors. You hear about eloquent last words. Goethe sitting up in bed, for example, saying, "More light," then falling back and expiring. And you hope that when your time comes, you can enter the zone of death with some grace, if not physically, then perhaps linguistically. But our family said and did nothing profound or poetic in the face of death. As the news of Mr. Thompson's failed surgery hit us, it circled the room like a telegraph, lighting up with surprise on my father's face and resting there for one big "who, me?" moment until my mother picked out the coupon circular from inside the newspaper and commented on something she needed that was on sale at Kmart. At one point, my sister bravely stood by my father's bed and asked him if he was able to take any comfort in his faith. The answer, which I strained to overhear, was either "not really" or "a little." Neither answer sounded encouraging to me. Could this be my father, who attended church every holy day and Sunday, who had carted me off to confession every Saturday? Was I such a lavish sinner that I needed confession that often? I remember sitting in the passenger seat of the pickup as we bumped toward town, feverishly concocting sins to tell the priest. "I have lied 7 times. And in this number I would include the lie I had just made up about lying 7 times. "I have disobeyed my parents." I liked the rhythm of this. And "I am sorry for these and all my sins." These days in the hospital room, a whole lifetime of church going didn't seem to offer any of us answers. Where had all that catechism training gone? Instead, I thought about Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's 5 stages of dying. We were vacillating between denial and bargaining, I suspected, and my mother vaguely recalled seeing a TV show about people who'd had near-death experiences, how they'd had this overwhelming impulse to go into the light. "They say you sometimes see relatives," my mother offered. "Well, I haven't seen any," my father mumbled. Most often, those last days, my father sat up in bed, looking perky even with his oxygen tube, his fluid drip, and his asymmetrically beating heart monitor. Even though the IVs in his veins were spreading purple bruises up his forearms, he still managed to joke about this, calling himself the human pincushion and flirting with the nurse when she removed him from his bed for his daily bowel movement, saying, "Ah, she just wants to be alone with me." But for all his bravado, it was impossible to ignore that he had begun to collect specialists. First a cardiologist, then a kidney man who guarded his fragile organs like a jealous lover. Each doctor advocating the rights of his respective body part, the cardiologist arguing finally and importantly that improving the blood flow would benefit the whole system. Also on the crew was the internist, who had reacquired my father's heartbeat 3 days earlier during the meltdown. This young doctor, having saved my father's life, now felt compelled to check on him, and we felt compelled to wave at him every time he passed by the door. Most recently joining the team was a handsome intensivist, which I later learned was the title for someone who specializes in intensive care medicine, and whom I later recognized as someone I had gone to college with. How strange to think of him, that big-haired, sonorous tenor in choir in the 70s, now saving lives in a hospital smock and Dockers in the 90s. And how strange, at the foot of my father's hospital bed, for small talk about college days to ensue. "And what was I up to?" the intensivist asked, out of politeness. "Guarding punctuation standards," I replied. In the bright hospital room, with machines humming and wheezing, with telephones ringing and crash carts beeping, someone in the background yelling, "Clear!" and the muffled names of doctors being paged in unknown codes, my job of scrutinizing the inscrutable semicolon didn't sound important, and certainly not significant enough to take me away from my father's hospital bed. But I had work to do. My parents had raised me that way, and now I needed to leave. This had been my second 800-mile trip from Iowa to Bismarck in the 10 days since the initial heart attack, and it was no longer possible to delay the progress of my students' lives. Each day that ticked off, my classes were producing papers I had not read. Finals, grading, and graduation were upon us, and no one in my family would have insisted that I stay. At the very least, my father seemed pleased that I knew the intensivist personally, as if the family now had a medical insider and all the specialists would be newly invested in his care, maybe even breaking out the top drawer, velvet-covered, under lock and key treatment. I once wrote a story called Smokes about a young woman, me, way back then, who was a road musician, which I was in my 20s, who comes home to visit her parents, mine, after a year-long road trip and little communication. The parents, surprised by her sudden appearance, greet her on the front stoop, with their hands awkwardly at their sides, as if afraid she will try to sell them a Kirby vacuum cleaner. All of this really happened, but I realized, after writing the story, that they were mostly worried about the oil from their daughter's old car, which was likely to drip, and did, onto their newly poured concrete driveway. In the story, Smokes, you immediately know that the parents don't approve of the young woman's activities. The father watches TV with a remote in his hand while the daughter tries to tell them about all the tourist sites she's visited, thinking that if they are not interested in her touring, perhaps they will be interested in her tourism. But they are interested in neither. It is clear all this has been argued about and left unresolved between them years before. So, what to do with a recalcitrant daughter? The father scans the channels, and the mother chats self-consciously about her part-time job. Eventually, the young woman retires to her bedroom, which has been converted to a guest room in her absence. She spends the weekend with the crisp doilies and the ever-staring eyes of her mother's new porcelain doll collection. Eventually, the young woman repacks her failing car, and the parents gather on the berm of the front lawn to wave goodbye. The father steps forward and leans into the front window to kiss her goodbye, she thinks. But instead, he slips a meticulously folded $50 bill into her palm and says, "Don't tell your mother." The daughter wants to tell him everything then, about the married guitar player, about how the band cheated her out of her money and equipment, and about how she has nowhere else to go. But the father backs up and slaps the fender of the rusting car like a palomino he's releasing into the wild, the story says. Mostly, the story is about the ends of ropes, the one the girl has reached, and the other she will reach for by the end of the story. It begins with the lines, "Here at last is the short end of the long rope her father warned her she would eventually come to. Long enough to hang yourself with," he had said, when he finally did say something to her that last time she went home. It's a figurative statement I heard often growing up, giving someone a rope long enough to hang themselves with. Meaning, I've always thought that it doesn't pay to rein someone in, trying to make them do what you want them to do. They'll just chomp harder at the bit and hate you for pulling it tight. Better to give them some rope. Let them have their own lead and a little headroom. Eventually, they'll do something stupid with all that freedom, and come back, hang-doggy, newly penitent, and beautifully self-trained. Writing about it now, I realize that the metaphor must originate in animal husbandry, perhaps horse training, and I imagine the technique works for the mildly stubborn horse. But what about the big, bad, wild one that I was as a young woman, headstrong, beautiful in my youth, wanting to blow off the doors and burn down the world? My neck stretched out to the absolute farthest reaches, my tongue out, my hair crazy in the wind, always breaking the rope's hold as it broke me. These days, I am haunted by the image of those sad dogs on long ropes you sometimes see in the yards of well-meaning owners, who perhaps want to give their pets roaming room during a long day away. But the long rope, whether given in love or discipline, is still a rope, and by the end of the long day, the poor animals are always hopelessly bound up, their feet and legs and neck all twisted and confused in the unbearable length of it. But what strikes me most, thinking about the long rope now, is the image it presents of the unbreakable connection we have with those we are born to, how those we are bound to can use it to hold, break, and ensnare us. And how sometimes, too, it can be the only thing that saves us, our last and final safety net. I once had a friend whose mother died the evening we were in night class together. When her roommates came to the classroom to get her, just to say something had happened, because nothing was known for sure, I still remember her sharp cry in the hallway, and the way her legs buckled under her, that kind of pure cellular response. She didn't even come back to the classroom to gather her books. She ran out of the building straight to her mother's bedside, which I see now is the absolutely right thing to do. Not the way we were doing it, with me standing by his bedside, leaning in to say goodbye, and him sitting up in his bed reading the morning paper, reminding me to check the fluid levels in my van, as if we were all back home in the kitchen, and I was on my way to an out-of-town basketball game. I was almost out of the hospital room when I saw the team of doctors assembling outside the door, talking quietly, in snapping charts, open and closed. I sat back down in the wooden chair, For days, we'd been waiting to hear what the doctors could do for our father, and getting on the road 1 hour later was not going to make any difference. Seeing the white coats gathering in the hallway caused my father to raise the Bismarck Tribune higher, chunk out the creases with one swift motion, and bury his face in it, as if the story on which his life depended lay in its crinkly sheets. It's a funny thing about the ICU. Each morning, the new shift nurse pulls wide the swinging curtain, greets you, and puts the new date on the message board, like a blue star you've earned for being good. And each morning, my father insisted on reading the newspaper front to back, while we all sat vigil in a circle around him. Maybe it was the sheer assertion of regularity, for certainly he kept himself alive 10 extra years simply by insisting on routine. Or maybe it was the comfort of looking in on the tragedy of others, that, oh, no, not me, feeling. Pick your baddest bad day, and you're sure to find someone in the newspaper who's having an even worse one. So, as my father's team of specialists filed in with the verdict on his tests and their strategies in hand, there he was, nose in the paper, impassively scanning the thin columns for someone else's disaster. The cardiologist took the center position at the foot of his bed, with all the blood tests and EKGs and X-rays administered to it. A body is always trying to tell a story, and this doctor had read more chapters of my father's narrative than anyone else in the room. He'd maneuvered my father through the failings of his heart and through the massive stroke 8 years before that had left him paralyzed on one side and in rehabilitation for 6 months. He'd conferred on my father's prostate surgery, as well as the removal of a malignant growth and the recurring gout. All his life, it seemed to me, my father had been this odd combination of fierceness and fragility. His body, small and failing, his mind, iron-willed and full of the angry teeth of survival. As an infant, he told me, he was once baptized in beer by a bunch of drunken uncles who christened him John. Perhaps it was fortunate that his mother stood firm and named him Felix, a name that means fruitful and fortunate, for my mother insisted that, like the famous cat, he had spent at least all of his 9 lives on his various health problems. There was the near brush with death at 3 when he contracted pneumonia, and the operation in his 20s when he'd had a tumorous lung removed at the Mayo Clinic, the place where all the famous sick people went. We were proud to have a dad who'd been sick enough to go to the Mayo. When we were kids, we liked to sit behind him when he had his shirt off and trace the long pink scar that ran down his spine from the base of his neck, then veered off to the left and under his shoulder blade, like a 24-inch zipper. "Oh, that bugger itches," he'd say when a rainstorm was approaching. We were impressed. Our father, the weatherman. These illnesses created a pattern in my parents' relationship. Our strong mother, with her near-perfect health, acted as the consummate doctoring partner for our stubborn father's failing health. Just as she was now, standing beside his bed to the left of the cardiologist, waiting to receive the latest news. Flanking the heart man on either side were the kidney man and the intensivist. They weaved in their Italian shoes, talking about dye tests, blocked arteries, triple bypasses, and stents, as my father listened coolly from behind his newspaper. He looked like a tiny, spoiled despot, whose reluctant generals, fearful for their heads, were making report on the bad turns at the Peloponnesian Wars. "I want to go home," my father sniffed apathetically and snapped the sports section. "Well, we'd all like that for you," the cardiologist shuffled his shoes. This was a dance they had done before, I could see, and although the doctor was younger and had more training, my father was dancing for his life. He was cagey and punch drunk, like those people you see at the end of dance-a-thons, bug-eyed from being dragged around the floor for too many hours. He'd had his first very slight heart attack almost 20 years earlier. I remembered it vividly because for years I believed, and perhaps even now believe, I was the cause of it. I recall I had just returned to the Midwest from a long road tour with my band, during which I hadn't phoned them. Our conversations back then only escalated into arguments about how I was wasting my life. But one day, back in the region, I saw that we had a gig not far from my hometown, and with a little arranging, I would be able to visit them for a few hours before going on to the performance. I steeled myself and made the phone call. They were surprised, but seemed happy to hear from me. We agreed that I would be there by dinner, and I set off on the road for the 3-hour drive to their house. But when I arrived, my father was not home. He was in the Wishick Hospital, 30 miles south of my hometown. In the 3 hours since I'd spoken to him, he'd had his first mild heart attack. It had begun with a tightness in his chest and a shortness of breath, my mother said, shortly after I'd called. It was lucky he'd gone straight to the clinic in town, she said, because they'd been able to minimize the damage when the attack came. Perhaps it was the narcissism of youth, but I'd never experienced that kind of direct cause-and-effect catastrophe before. I had experienced some weird coincidences. I might be thinking of someone, and the phone would ring and that person would be on the other end of the line. I often had problems with electromagnetic activity. Watches stopped on my wrist. Sometimes whole rows of streetlights blacked out as I walked or drove by them. I seemed to blow out light bulbs at a phenomenal rate, and often small electrical appliances smoked and died in my hands. But causing my own father's heart attack? This was getting scary. And the situation got even more serious when I arrived at the hospital. I found him lying on his back on the hospital bed. He was prone and swaddled in white, still as a mummy. I'd only been there a few minutes, sitting quietly by his bed. I hadn't spoken a word when the nurses came to remove me. My presence had made his heart monitors bing and bong with fibrillation. So much for the comfort of a loving daughter. But all these years later, it was different. There was still a current that ran like a wild shot of 220 between us, but maybe our polarities had shifted. This time, I felt my presence calmed him. Whenever possible, I tried to lean through the wall of machinery and touch him, to break down the barrier, and I noticed that no matter how bad he was feeling, he lifted his head or pulled his body up to receive my kisses. This was hard to believe from our brusque father, who would interrupt our stories when we were young with, "Ah, you're just a dumb kid." It took me 30 years to figure out that this was his backhanded expression of love, the best he could manage without feeling foolish. Now here was our gruff father, reduced to a hospital bed, and suddenly the willing recipient of our love. And here is where we must stop our narrative for today. You have been listening to The Horizontal World, Growing Up Wild in the Middle of Nowhere, by Deborah Marquardt, Professor of English and Director of the Creative Writing Program at Iowa State University. The Community Bookshelf is broadcast on KHOI-FM every Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday at this time. Producer is Mary Richards. Assistant producer is Janet Kloss, and chief engineer is Rick Morrison. We welcome your comments and suggestions at 292-2878 or khoiradio@gmail.com. If you want to hear prior episodes of the broadcast, visit the KHOI website and click on Community Bookshelf. This is Mary Richards. Thank you very much for listening.